Brian, you came up to Alaska, as I understand, looking for a job fighting forest fires, and that didn't necessarily turn out so well. You ended up falling in love with the state for other reasons than the potential job putting out fires. What was it that made you fall in love with Alaska?
I don't know. It just seemed like a place where there was lots of opportunity, lots of beauty and wilderness, and lots of good people.
Yeah. And you were able to find that out. And how long were you up here when you came up that first time?
Well, I came up in May of 1970 and really made the decision by August to stay and transfer to the University of Alaska.
Were there any particular experiences during that time that kind of stuck out to you as being reasons why you fell in love with the state? Or was it just sort of a general vibe that you got?
I think it was just a general vibe that I got. That just it seemed that there were great people around. The university was fairly small at the time, much more personal. I'd been going to Brown University, a much larger institution, and the people just seemed very friendly.
Yeah. In the Aurora article, it says that your nickname is the Flowmaster, which I have to say is probably one of the coolest nicknames that I've heard before. Sort of makes me think of you like shooting threes over and over again in a basketball court or something like that. How did you get the nickname the Flowmaster?
Well, that actually came up when I managed the Glass Bead Game, a band in Fairbanks in the early 1970s. I managed a tour through Alaska for the band, and my job really was to keep things flowing, to make sure that all 11 band members got to the right place at the right time, that all the equipment and the road people were there, that we had gigs lined up in each community or were ready to line one up when we arrived.
Okay. And how did you get involved with the glass bead game? How did that become a, how did you end up managing that?
Well, they were all friends from the university. Every single member of the band attended the university at one time or another. That's we hung out at the sub and then at the Wood Center, I think that's where we got to know each other.
How would you describe their style of music?
Rock and roll, some blues, little bit of everything. Van Morrison, a lot of Van Morrison tunes, and a great dance band.
Good. Are you still connected with some of the members of that band?
Yeah, in fact, we actually in 2012, they had a 40-year reunion for the band. Everybody came up. Excuse me, that would have been 14. Everybody came up and played again here on campus, and then out at the Loon.
Nice. Do you remember any specific events during your job as a band manager that stuck out as maybe particularly challenging for you as a manager, or did things go pretty well?
Things went pretty well, but the logistics of getting the bus, the Volkswagen van, the cars, getting all 11 band members, the cook, the two on the road crew, and the dogs all to the right place at the right time, finding places to camp out while we were there. That was a challenge at times.
Would you say it maybe helped you later on in your career with some of the challenges that you would face as a chancellor and other things like that, getting everyone in the same place at the same time?
Well, that and I think just dealing with logistics generally and knowing that, you know, to be successful, all the stuff in the background needs to work as well. And so sort of understanding that at the detail level certainly helped later when I became chancellor and I think in other areas as well.
Would you recommend band managing as a potential career skill that a young student might want to try and take on?
It sure was a lot of fun.
It was also really interesting to hear that you sold lemonade from a truck on campus. It was called the Lemon Tree.
Yes.
How did that get started?
Actually read an article in the Mother Earth News that talked about people making and selling fresh lemonade, and a friend and I decided to try to do it as a mobile operation, and so bought at a post office auction, bought an old one-ton post office van, painted it up, and started trying different places. And it turned out that parking in front of the UA Museum was the best place to sell. That's now Signers Hall, right outside where my office was, until the 1st of September.
Okay. And it went well, it worked out for you.
It went pretty well. There were some challenges. The university didn't like having a mobile food vendor on campus. And the vice president ordered the one of the executives to get rid of that kid. Fortunately, the person he asked was Ron Kais, who's still here in town and still a good friend. And Ron was the director of the Woods Center. And Ron came to me and said, you've got a problem. The administration wants you off. But if you had a contract with ARA Services, who's the food vendor, I wouldn't be able to kick you off.
Wink, wink.
And so I went down to ARA and did a contract with them that provided that I sold their sandwiches along with my fresh squeezed lemonade, orange juice, and limeade. And that way, Ron had to go back to the vice president and say, sorry, he's got a contract with the food service vendor. I can't do anything about it. So I'm forever indebted to Ron Kais.
Did you ever hope to see more food vendors on campus when you were chancellor? Did you ever think about encouraging other people to do that?
Yes, and in fact, we've seen more food vendors on campus in part because of that, and I think others have wanted to see it as well. So seeing the pita place in Wood Center last winter, or seeing Alaska Coffee Roasting at the Museum of the North, and we've encouraged in the new contract other opportunities to arise to see local vendors have an opportunity to sell here on campus.
You've worked in politics, you've worked in the private sector, and you've even worked in what you called semi-commercial fishing. What drew you to dedicate the final years of your professional life to education?
Well, I've always had a connection to the University of Alaska and the University of Alaska Fairbanks, really since I arrived. That was the transfer that I did in 1970. And, you know, I served as a member of the Board of Regents for a full 8-year term, including 3 as chair, and developed a really good relationship with former President Mark Hamilton during that period. And about a year after my term on the Board of Regents was over, the chancellor at UAF left, and Mark asked if it would be possible for me to step in for a year or two as chancellor. And at the time, I thought it was only going to be a year or two. Mm. But at the end of the first year, the Faculty Senate asked the president to cancel a search and suggested that he ask me to stay. He did. And, you know, I found I enjoyed the job. I felt like I was making a difference. And really, it was the best job of my life.
Really? In what way compared to what you've done in the other elements of your career?
Well, you know, I think fundamentally higher education has such a great opportunity to transform people's lives, both from the educational process in teaching, but also in terms of what our research can do to help advance human understanding of the world and of each other. And every day as chancellor, I would learn something new about what we were doing. You know, we have these fantastic faculty supported by great staff who do amazing things. And one of the joys of the job of chancellor, you know, you're not going deep into any of those, but you get the opportunity to learn about areas you might never have known anything about. And that happens day after day after day, week after week. And I think my final speech to the Fairbanks Chamber, I titled it, I Had No Idea. And that's a term I've heard over and over again from people from the lower 48 or from abroad who've come to this campus to find out about the Arctic or to find out about what's going on. And they keep saying, I had no idea there was so much going on here. Mm. And for a tiny university that's a long way away from sort of the hub of American higher education, there are great things happening here.
Yeah. The state of Alaska and UAF are facing tough financial times right now, but this is not the first time you've seen this. What did you learn from the drop in oil prices in 1986 that forced deep cuts and restructuring of the University of Alaska system?
Well, first, that a university is pretty resilient. We went through those cuts and came out again and kept doing the great things I was just describing. I also learned that it's very difficult to have the kind of process you like to have when you're cutting budgets. Building a budget, it's great to have a highly participatory process and people bring good ideas. But in the academic setting, it's very hard for faculty members and staff to either suggest cuts in their own programs or to go attacking other people's programs. And so the process of reduction ends up being a smaller group of people making final decisions, trying to get as much input as possible, but not the level of participation that I would like to see, or I think that we expect in a normal budgetary process. So that would be one piece, is that it's less participatory. Second, you lose good things even when you try not to. Mm. That the impacts of particularly of several years worth of reductions in terms of morale, in terms of some of your best faculty members choose to go elsewhere because they see greater opportunities. Staff are tend to be the first hit, and so we end up with work overloads there. So there's a real impact on the people, and it really takes a lot of work to try to minimize that impact and to continue to find ways to reward people who have stellar performance or to motivate people to hope for the end of the trough. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons that the philosophy while I was chancellor, and I think that will continue, is that we actually cut a little bit further than we have to so we can reinvest in some areas. So there's always every year some hope for reinvestment or growth. And I think having that opportunity for reinvestment or growth is also critical to the future. If you're not doing some investing, you'll just keep withering and dying as opposed to regenerating.
Interesting. Do you have ideas on how to improve morale and hope when you're in the depths of that trough?
Well, the first certainly is that reinvestment opportunity. Uh-huh. The second is that at the administrative level, to keep looking for ways to unblock people's creativity, to get bureaucratic processes out of the way of the people who have good ideas, and to find ways to encourage experimentation, to encourage people to try things that might yield new revenues or better processes. One of the problems I've seen in the public sector generally is there are not, in the private sector, if you do spectacular things, there are rewards for doing so. And so people will take risks knowing I may only have a third of a chance of succeeding and two-thirds of failing, but if I succeed, there's a great reward. In the public sector and in the academy, there tend to be penalties if you make mistakes, but not rewards if you take appropriate risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a second thing is to encourage people to take risks, and if they fail, learn from those and try something new again. And certainly that's the methodology in research, but to apply that to administrative processes and to other processes, I think is important. And I think if people feel the freedom to experiment, the freedom to innovate, we'll see great things.
How do you reward faculty and staff at a university for innovation? I remember at a meeting once you talked about in the private sector, people are rewarded with time off as one of them with the main ways, and I imagine bonuses too. How do you do that in academia? Because I certainly understand what you're saying. It tends to be like there's not a whole lot of reward for innovation. If anything, you might catch some flack from people for rocking the boat.
Well, first of all, and one of the things I think we've done right in the last decade is to move for those areas of innovation that lead to intellectual property disclosures and potential revenue. The lion's share of the early revenue goes to the faculty or staff member who came up with the idea. So
okay.
That's one that applies in some areas. I think a second is public recognition of accomplishments. And so trying to highlight those, trying to tout those, trying to recognize people in front of their peers is a good way to motivate. We have a limited ability to do bonuses. They're very modest compared with what you see in the private sector. Financial rewards are certainly appropriate when we can afford them. There's certainly less of that now. And then I think the other is to listen to people's frustrations and find ways to clear them out. And again, that's getting rid of the processes that get in people's ways. Sometimes that's a great reward in itself. And certainly what we've seen with the process improvement teams at UAF, the people who put in the extra work to think about how to improve processes get the reward if the processes actually get improved.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like to think that most people don't get into academia for the money, but because they really have a passion for teaching and research and that kind of thing. So a bonus may not be as motivating to them as having them feel like the university appreciates and recognizes what they do.
Yes. But,
yeah. You said in your email to university employees last April that the struggles UAF has been facing have taken a physical toll on you. You've made a career out of negotiating tough situations. What was different this time?
I think there were several things. The failings that we've had, I guess I took personally. So where we had non-compliance with NCAA or the problem with injections at the community and technical college where some students were, those kinds of things really affected me personally, and I really, you know, took those as personal failures that we didn't anticipate, that we weren't doing the right things, and so I think that was certainly a piece of the stress level. I think a second one was, given my time at this university and in Fairbanks, I knew both personally most of the people who were being affected by the negative budget decisions. And, you know, each one of those, it accumulates. You feel that impact on friends, on colleagues, on people you respect. And I think that was somewhat different from, you know, maybe it's easier for someone who isn't as familiar with everyone. You don't feel it as personally when you make those tough decisions.
Did you see those things sort of coming, or was this sort of a surprise to you this was so difficult?
I think it was a bit of a surprise. I think we were all surprised by the suddenness and depth of the drop in oil prices. We all knew there'd need to be some tightening, but for it to come this hard and fast, I think was really a surprise to everyone who follows oil prices. And so that sort of going through that a second round, I sort of felt, well, I've been here before. I'm not sure I want to go through that a second round.
And what do you see on the horizon now for Alaska? Having been through this once before, do you see things coming down the road in the next 5-10 years in particular?
Well, I think we're going to need to see a state fiscal structure that's more like other states. And actually, I expect to do some work on the fiscal issues in the state, volunteer or otherwise, because I think all of us have a stake in adequate public services in Alaska. I expect that the righting the ship, getting things appropriate for state government, will require some use of permanent fund income to help support state services, which was what was anticipated in the mid-1970s when the permanent fund itself was created. I would expect that there would be some taxes, whether sales tax, income tax, a little bit of each, and I would expect some further reductions to the state budget and maybe some tweaks to the oil tax regime, particularly in the production tax credits, setting some limits on those. I think if all of those steps are put together, we'll see a stabilization. It may be about a 10% reduction to 15% reduction from where we are today. That will require legislative action, and it's really tough for the legislature. I recently read a quote from the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, who said in a similar situation, "We know what we have to do. we just don't know how to get reelected after we do it. And I think that's the dilemma our legislators face today. And I really have a lot of respect for those in both parties who are stepping out and saying, we're going to have to bite the bullet and address it during the 2016 legislative session.
What about for UAF? Do you have a sense of what's coming down the road for the university?
Well, and because we are the fourth biggest expenditure in state government, clearly anything on the budget reduction side, there will be a share at UAF and at UA generally. I actually think we're likely to bottom out sometime in the next 2 years, and that the reductions won't be as severe after that as they've been the last two or three, and that we will see some opportunities for growth and new areas. Certainly the fact that this is the U.S. chairmanship of the Arctic Council, the strong interest at the federal government level in the Arctic, President Obama's announcement of dozens of new investments in Arctic-related issues benefit America's Arctic University. And so I think for those areas of UAF that have a strong affiliation toward Arctic issues, we'll see opportunities that maybe haven't been there as much the last couple of years. I think on the research side, there's greater opportunity for growth than on the teaching side in the short term, partly because the flow of students coming out of Alaska high schools is not expected to grow much in the next several years.
On a lighter note, your mustache has garnered kind of its own fans here at UAF. What is it what do you think it is about your mustache that appeals to so many students and, dare I say, faculty, staff?
I don't have the foggiest idea. That one was a huge surprise when I saw the Facebook page for it. For the chancellor's mustache.
I believe there's a T-shirt too.
Yeah, and there, I see it in the Sun Star from time to time. So I'm not sure what Mike Powers or his successor will do that has the same level of impact. Sometimes the things that happen are a big surprise.
I imagine your wife is probably a big fan of the mustache, I would hope.
I hope so. You know, and Sherry's been affiliated with the university as long as I have, and she retired several years ago so she could devote full time to being an advocate for the university. And
yeah.
We're pretty proud of what we've done in the development arena, the total funds raised over the course of the 7 years that I was chancellor, in excess of $100 million between corporate philanthropy and individual. We're really pleased to see the kind of momentum that's come out of that and look forward to, emeriti, continuing to work to try to raise money for some of the areas we care the most about.
Mm-hmm. You're stepping down now from official work for UAF. You're certainly not, from what I understand, stepping away from UAF as a whole. What does UAF mean to you now at this point in your life? What is UAF to you?
Well, certainly, as I said before, it is that power to transform people and society and the best force for change in society for improving Alaska. I really see what we do, everything from training a workforce to providing research that helps change people's understanding of the world or potentially change healthcare or any one of a number of areas. The applications of the research are what I think is going to help us survive being a commodity-based state. So to me, UAF and the university as a whole are about the future of Alaska.
What's in your future? What are you up to now?
Well, we're taking some time off, vacationing for a while, visiting family around the country. And next summer, our plan is to build on property we purchased in the Kopanen family subdivision on Chena Ridge. And we'll just see what happens from there. We're open to new opportunities.
Brian, thanks so much for talking to me, and thank you for your service to UAF.
Thank you.